This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, June 10th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us, and again, a big welcome back to the Bay to many of you. Coming up this week, the Ugashic fishing boundaries are going to change.
Well, the reasoning is that the animals are there, and there are lots of federal regulations that require certain distances be kept from endangered or threatened species.
Area Manager Paul Solomon offers context on the decision just made minutes ago. Staff to the local boundary commission kicked out a preliminary report nixing the competing annexation petitions and recommending Western Bristol Bay become a borough already. Dillingham's Mayor Alice Ruby joins to discuss.
I think we are supportive of both. I mean, we'd like to see regional government. We'd like to be part of that government, but we need to generate revenue right now, so we'd like to see the annexation go forward.
We'll check in on two villages aiming to process and sell fish one of these days. Plus, we'll hear from some Bristol Bay fishermen who are getting airborne to take their fishing stories and sales to the East Coast.
I think we marketed on our page as from our nets to your table.
Plus, a Lake and Penn teacher from Port Hyden tells about last year's summer foot and pack raft adventure on the peninsula and about her even bigger plans for this summer.
Our motto of the trip was embrace the suck. So, like any adventure, you take one day at a time and you troubleshoot one problem at a time, and it's all just a challenge, and I guess overcoming those challenges is what makes it exciting.
Those stories and more are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Salmon fishing is getting underway in southwest Alaska, with a small but yet confidential number of sockeye landed in Igigik this week. In Area M, drifters mainly out of Nelson Lagoon have brought in a few thousand fish. On the Pacific side, Sandpoint set netters have caught about 30,000 sockeye, and another 30,000 have been landed between the Dolgoys, Shumigans, and South Unimak. Fish and Game says those sockeye are averaging 5.9 pounds. The Chignicks took off with a surprising surge of sockeye past the weir. Biologist Don Wilburn said earlier this week she opened the fleet in a hurry last Saturday.
Mainly due to the fact that we were seeing a large number of fish for this time of year, and we're well over our escapement objectives for this time, and had also some of the largest counts we've had probably in the last 20 years.
The run tapered off a bit, and Wilburn says it's hard to explain the large early push. The fleet has landed about 27,000 sockeye. The weir has now counted 73,000. The Pandalus, the vessel that operates the test fishery at Port Moeller, underwent some repairs in Homer, but is now on its way to Bristol Bay. It should begin operations on the 11th, more likely the 12th, which is a day later than usual. Nooshigak king salmon have been showing up in fair numbers over the past week, with some very successful subsistence catches reported Thursday night and Friday morning on Kanakanak Beach. Fish and Game doesn't produce a forecast for Noosh Kings anymore, but does manage for 95,000 in-river escapement. Area Manager Tim Sands says he doesn't see any directed king openings happening for the commercial fleet this season.
One of the big reasons for that is because we're trying to start fishing for sockeye earlier, because it's a big sockeye run, and we don't want to have foregone harvest in the sockeye. But when we do that, we overlap more with the king return, and so there's more potential for incidental harvest of kings.
The Dillingham Harbor has been dredged and is ready to home port the West Side Fleet. Harbor Master Gene Barrett says more and more of the silty material is being pumped out into the bay every year.
3 years ago, we pumped, I believe, 97,000 cubic yards out of here. Last year was 113,000 cubic yards, and I think this year it's probably going to be up in the 126,000 cubic yards.
The dredging is managed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Many local residents say they'd prefer to see that material pumped inland to dry and for use, rather than back into the bay where some believe it is adding mud to once rocky beaches. Staff for the local boundary commission released a report last week recommending against annexation of the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District by either Dillingham or Manicotic. The two competing petitions have been under consideration all year. Manicotic's mayor, Melvin Andrews, says he's disappointed by the report, and his city will keep up its efforts to annex the Agushik section to collect a raw fish tax.
We have been attempting to maintain our ancestral rights to keep Agushik managed through our tribe and municipal entities. The tribe has not been able to move forward with it, so that the city has moved forward when we had the chance with it, as well as in attempts to oppose Dillingham's attempts to annex areas strongly related to Manicotic.
The report took issue with the overlapping boundaries around the Ingushetia section and how the landed fish in that area would be divided between the two cities for attacks. In Juneau, the legislative session continues. This week, the Senate passed a bill that would restructure the permanent fund to use some of its earnings as state revenues. The idea is a cornerstone of Governor Bill Walker's plan to reshape Alaska's finances away from dependency on oil revenues and towards a sovereign wealth model. That bill is now under consideration in the House and will be taken up next week. On our crime and safety beat, Adrian Mark from Dillingham pleaded guilty last week and will be sentenced to 3 years to serve for selling two doses of heroin to a police confidential informant. And this week, a similar DPD case against Alexandra Anguson, now of Wasilla, was dismissed by the prosecution for lack of sufficient evidence. And troopers say they will charge two Quinnahock tribal police officers, one for furnishing alcohol to a minor in a dry village and the other for second-degree sexual assault. State troopers allege the two men drank confiscated alcohol in the jail with teenage girls, engaging in sexual activity while they were on duty back in May. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. There's big news out here just in the last few minutes. The boundaries to the Ugashik Fishing District will change this season. Area Manager Paul Solomon spoke with us minutes ago for more. Paul, good morning, and I would say this isn't completely unexpected news, but what are the details and what's the reasoning?
Well, the reasoning is that the animals are there, and there are lots of federal regulations that require certain distances be kept from endangered or threatened species. That's the short story. We're going to move it back a mile. We're going to move the north line of Ugashik back a mile to try and satisfy those. Right now, everybody's in agreement that that's a good number to use to start with. We'll see how it goes from there. And by everybody, it's federal entities as well as the state.
Okay. Has there been any consultation with the fleet that fishes there usually, or are they going to learn about this today?
They're going to learn about it today.
Do you expect to hear any concerns? Is that a line that sees a lot of activity, or can it be bumped back and still be an effective fishery?
It can still be an effective fishery. We've had some comments about it, but really they're not something that enter into the equation here.
Okay.
So there's federal regulations. These are they're not listed, but they are listed as threatened, and as a result, we have to kind of maintain some separation between us and them.
I can just pretty much guarantee you we're going to play that Beatles song quite a bit this fishing season.
I'm already catching it.
The Year of the Walrus.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, before we let you off the line, we'll catch up with you next week for the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report, but your district has seen a little bit of catch. Is it anything unusual or any kind of size showing up? Anything that you can tell
us? It's within the realm of normal in terms of expecting something to be caught. Typically, we see first deliveries around the 5th to the 10th. We saw some on the 8th. And beyond that, I can't say much because there's too few fishermen and too few processors involved. The information is still proprietary.
Very good. Paul Solomon, so far in Anchorage, next week at the King Salmon Fishing Game Office, the area management biologist for Ugashik and Igigig districts, with the news today that the Ugashik boundary will change on account of the walrus. Paul, thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
Probably all know the lyrics to that song by the end of the summer. For decades, many of the processors in Bristol Bay have been large companies with roots in Washington and parent companies in foreign countries, but two small communities are developing locally owned processing plants. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
Bristol Bay's fishing communities have long been dependent on the companies that turn raw fish into a marketable product and get it shipped out of the bay. The communities of Port Hyden and Leavelock now want to take on that role themselves and hopefully keep more of the decisions and the benefits local. Native Village of Port Hyden Business Development Director Adrienne Christensen says the Meshek Processing Center there should be up and running this summer.
We wanted to start a local tribally owned fish processing plant so that we could create a longer season for our fishermen, also to have our fishermen fish close to home so that they don't have to go all the way up to Ugashik to fish, and to provide them with a higher price for their fish, because we'll be doing direct marketing and have a higher quality product that will mean more jobs and more pay for the fishermen.
Right now, the village is waiting on some freezer equipment ordered from Anchorage. Once it arrives and the fish are hitting, they'll buy up to 10,000 pounds per day. Hopefully, she says, from local fishermen. There's about half a dozen Bristol Bay fishery permit holders living in Port Hyden. Their fish will get sold around the state.
We're focusing on Alaska markets first. So selling to the school district, selling to Anchorage markets, and selling to local stores first.
Once things really get going, Christensen says the Meshick Processing Center wants to buy during a longer season than typical processors, starting with Kings and staying open through Silvers. They also want to expand and purchase a Japanese freezer system.
We are working on getting that technology, but because it's very expensive, we are getting the funding together to be able to purchase it. The one small freezer system that we want to purchase is over $1 million.
Meanwhile, leave-lock packing is probably a year out. Village Council President Alexander Talik-Balak says they're waiting on final approval for a $2 million infrastructure grant from the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. In the meantime, they've been building the plant piece by piece using community block grants for the past 5 years.
Right now, we have about $1.8 million into the project. Every year, we purchase materials and equipment and build a processing plant with local hire. And all the projects were small projects, but at the end of the day, we're going to have a fully equipped processing plant.
Last winter, the community went to the State Board of Fisheries and asked for more commercial fishing opportunity on the Alagnac River. After BBEDC agreed to help fund it, the board agreed to create a new management plan there, about 8 miles from the village. Leave-Lock Packing hopes to buy fish from the 5 local permit holders in Leave-Lock, as well as others from the region who want to fish the new area, including setnetters from Dillingham, Iliamna Lake area, and Naknek Quijack. They also think they'll do so during a longer season.
We would be open to shoulder seasons in the beginning and toward the end, which means, you know, we plan to fish before the regular commercial sockeye season, and then we plan to do some fall fishing after the commercial sockeye season. We'd like to do silvers and chums, and that'll keep our fish plant open longer.
Despite the plans for a building and a fishery, Leave-Lock doesn't know exactly where it'll sell the fish. Talik-Palik says a roundtable is planned this fall to work on marketing plans and also figure out what sort of product the plant will sell, whether frozen fillets or something else. For both communities, the plants are part of a larger effort to develop more robust local economies.
Right now, our community is about 70-some people. The majority of us adults here, we all have jobs with the fish plant, with our barge, and with the high tunnel, and some of the small grant projects that we've got here. So, you know, we're all getting a lot of work and a lot of excitement with the fish processing plant.
The Leave-Lock plant has been in the works for more than 2 decades, and only time will tell if 2017 will finally be its year. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. A local Boundary Commission staff report out this week may have put the kibosh on Anishinaabeg District fish tax anytime soon. For a little frame of reference here, Dillingham voters adopted annexation in 2012. It was overturned in court in 2014. The City Council approved resubmitting the petition last year, and in the interim, the City of Manicotic submitted its own petition to annex the Agushik section only. Both cities aim to collect a raw fish tax. Critics say the resource should go to others in the region, too. The LBC staff say the area would be better off as a new borough. For more, I'm joined by Dillingham's Mayor Alice Ruby, Thank you for your time. Alice, good to have you in.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming back on the program. Yeah. Explain in your to your thinking what this LBC staff report indicates for Dillingham's plan to annex the Nooshogak District. To me, it looked like they said not at this time or maybe never.
Well, yeah, that's probably a good interpretation. It says the report, as I've read it, says that the staff does not feel that our annexation petition meets the standards for annexation, which is a surprise to us because this is the petition that, you know, just 2 years ago they said did meet the standards. What they're including in their comments this time is, you know, reference to a borough being, in their opinion, a better choice. But what's also interesting is they're not recommending that the LBC do a petition to create a borough. It's very soft, and I don't know what that means or what we do with that. If you read in there, it says they recommend that the LBC recommend to the legislature that they do something. So
okay. Well, let's come back to that borough part in just a second. But with the annexation plan, the city council had adopted this plan again, or this time, and it was intending to go to the legislature for approval if the LBC signed off on it.
That's correct.
So, but that's now looks like off the table.
Well, no, not necessarily. This is, if you look at that this is the preliminary staff recommendation. There's a comment period. At the end of the comment period, the staff then issued their final recommendation. So this is preliminary. They're looking for feedback, looking for comments. Once they issue then the final recommendation, it goes to the LBC. When the LBC, you know, makes a decision finally, they could adopt this recommendation or not. They could choose to go forward with one or both petitions. So it doesn't really take anything off of the table officially, although the staff recommendation is pretty integral to the whole process. So, and very interesting, you know, the position they're taking on the two Dillingham and Manicoke petitions.
And that's it seems that's the main thing that changed was that since Dillingham had its annexation in place, then it was overturned in court, then Manicoke submitted what was called a competing petition, though they're really trying to target the Agushik section. That's the main element I think the LBC recognized it has changed, is that other communities would like access to that raw fish tax as well.
I think that, at least the way I read it, that's what has caused the staff to pause and take a different look.
Okay. The idea of the fish tax has been hotly debated amongst folks for a long time here. You have supported the idea of the fish tax. What do you tell people about it today? The finances have gotten a little bit worse for the city over the past few years. How important is that fish tax to you, or would that be more of a burden on people now?
It's hard to just say yes or no to that. A fish tax in this district, it has a financial impact, but the fish tax is being paid in every other district. So, you know, the fishers that fish in Igigik or Bristol Bay Borough, wherever, or even Togiak, you know, there are fish taxes. As far as the fish tax is necessary to support a borough on this side, I think the most recent study was the one that Ecock Village Council did, and I think it did show a higher tax. But that's not the only study. There have been several others in the past produced, and it would take some creativity to create a borough here, to fund it, to make it meet what the residents want, but carry you know, the financial stuff. It takes some creativity. And I guess we'll see what comes out of the discussion that's going to get generated by this newest report.
You've been a part of this whole discussion for a long time here. What's your sense about Dillingham's neighbors? Have they softened to the idea of being included in a borough, with Dillingham no doubt as the seat of the borough?
Well, I have been involved for a while. Actually, many of the players that are now in this have been involved for a while. Even those that are opposed to the current city's annexation have been involved. I guess my sense is There is still fear out there of a borough where the largest population is in Dillingham. It's not the only issue. We, you know, in Dillingham, we worry about having to share schools, or we worry about sharing the responsibility for services region-wide instead of in our city. So there's kind of concerns on both sides. I do get a sense, though, that there's a little more support. And part of that maybe comes from the continuing concern about the Pebble Mine, and gosh, could we pull that into a borough where maybe there's more influence? But also, as the number of permits have declined in region, there's also more support from people who would just like to generate, you know, that income from, you know, this industry that's less and less resident owned. So I think things have changed a little bit to the better, but there is still a lot of people worried about it, worried about, you know, how much influence they would have on a borough if it were formed.
Looking down the road in 5 or 10 years, what do you envision? What do you hope will be in place?
Well, I think that for the city, we hope that the annexation will be in place, that we'll be generating revenue. I think the city of Dillingham hopes that the discussion on boroughs goes forward as well, because I think we are supportive of both. I mean, we'd like to see regional government. We'd like to be part of that government, but we need to generate revenue right now, so we'd like to see the annexation go forward.
Alice Ruby is Dillingham's mayor. No doubt this conversation will go on in the weeks and months ahead, and we'll have you back as that as needs be. But Alice, thanks so much as always.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
First 3G, then 4G, now drones. Technology is making it easier for Bristol Bay fishermen to connect with potential customers. KDLG's Shaylin Cochran spoke with one boat captain who has enlisted some aerial help to market his catch.
Say hello to one of the newest marketing tools for salmon in Bristol Bay.
This is a little DJI Phantom 2 drone. It's kind of an older model.
That's Xander Jameson, captain of the Bucco. His drone has garnered plenty of attention out here in the boatyard, and it does look like a pretty fun toy. Dogs are definitely captivated by it at takeoff, but it's also a useful tool. He's using it to shoot video of his summer fishing season, which helps tell the story of the fish he sells back in Virginia. Jameson says he didn't think to use the drone for business until he actually had one called, what else, Captain Zan's Fishy Business.
And then last year we decided, since we could never find wild salmon other than the salmon that we brought home for ourselves in the store, we'd start selling it. So I bought a whole bunch back from the seafood market, and we started marketing it to seafood restaurants in our area, little restaurants in our area, little stores, and slowly but surely it gathered a clientele. And then we got into a farmer's market in Alexandria, right outside of D.C., and started selling fish on the weekends.
They had found their niche. Week after week, Xander and his mate, Haley Payne, sold out early and spent afternoons promising to bring more next time. It was a good problem to have and a good opportunity to tell the story of these fish that come from some 4,000 miles away.
They don't understand. They're just like, oh, so fish happens. So we tell them about it, and we tell them about the process, and we tell them what it's like to be on a boat for however many weeks at a time, potentially without showers or bathrooms or anything like that. And they're just fascinated. I'm really excited that we can put videos up so they can see that while we're gone, so they can see what we're doing just to bring this to them.
One of the big challenges we have when people get more and more interested in local food is that we're not close to a lot of the markets.
That's Tyson Fick. He's the communications director for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute.
It's absolutely key to us in telling the brand story and increasing the value of seafood to talk about the locale, the place, and the people who make it possible for high-quality Alaska seafood to enter the market.
Everyone wants local, or in the absence of local, they at least want to know more about where their food comes from. And that's why the drone.
Right, it's going to land on the either right on top of us or right on top of the container.
Yeah. Never even mind that. Think about how Twitter and Instagram, we're not Twitter people, like, we're not, but we tried it, and just having a Twitter, tagging him in Twitter, grew our business so much.
It's probably the easiest, cheapest, quickest way to advertise, and when you've got a story or even a little movie to go along with it, it's not too hard of a sell.
I dropped off a filet to this chef and a sous chef, and I got a call a few days later, and he said, how can I get more of this? How much of this do you have? I said, well, I have as much of it as you want. How much do you want? He said, bring me a case Thursday.
And for the chefs back east, Jameson, the Bristol Bay Fleet, and just the salmon-loving public at large, Thursday can't come soon enough. In Dillingham, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
And Shaylin Cochran is the newest member of our KDLG news team. Joins Molly Dishner, Hannah Colton, and myself, Dave Benninger. We'll be here with you every step of the way this summer. Don't hesitate to reach out. Our final story this week, we teased this a few weeks ago. A new friend of ours, Casey Luke, who is a counselor for the Lake and Peninsula School District and lives in Port Hyden, told us a story we had been hearing about since last summer. She and others went on a 180-mile human-powered trip from Port Hyden to Chignik Lagoon over 12 days. Now she and some others are underway on another trip, similar but even more intense. Very inspiring to hear. I spoke with her before they embarked on this new trip. Casey, good to speak with you, by the way. And I've heard about this trip that happened last year. Share some of these details. Who was involved and what did you guys undertake?
So four Lake and Penn School District employees, as well as two folks from Anchorage, actually an Alaska State Trooper and his girlfriend, we left Port Hyden and we were hauled up dry riverbed toward the caldera where we climbed to the rim and then hiked down into the caldera and spent some time before we rafted out Surprise Lake and on the Aniakchak River to the Pacific coast. And that part of the trip took about 4 days. So on night four, we ended up in the cabin there at the Aniakchak, the mouth of the Aniakchak, and it was lovely to dry out because it had rained every day.
Of course.
Up to that point. Right. And so we spent two nights there drying out, and when we were at that cabin, we experienced the earthquake that took place just in the Pacific. The epicenter was about 5 miles from where
right.
we were, and that was really interesting.
Wow,
it was
you were
11 o'clock tonight.
Yeah, you were close to that one.
Yeah, it felt close. And we had some bear encounters while we were out there. We hiked then and pack rafted to Chignik Lagoon from the cabin. So that was it took about 12 days was the trip total last summer.
So Casey, you know, a lot of us don't undertake these big kind of human powered trips around here for whatever reasons. It could be spongy tundra or just lack of interest. But what was your thought coming out of this trip? Was this kind of a new experience for you? And did you think that our Southwest environment, or yours rather, down there on the peninsula, was hospitable to such an endeavor?
Well, I've lived in Port Hyden for 4 years, and I think knowing that the least visited national monument is in our backyard is pretty intriguing. And the fact that we do take trips there to the rim pretty regularly, I shouldn't say regularly, I should say once or twice a year. But for us, that's a good amount of visits because people don't get there. You know, it's the least visited national monument, so why not take advantage of this being in our backyard and at our disposal?
How were the traveling conditions, both on foot and for rafting?
Our motto of the trip was embrace the suck. So we never really faced amazing sunshine weather. We never really thought that it was easy going, to be perfectly honest.
Okay.
I mean, it was a challenge at every turn. We did face a lot of alders. Our only hope were game trails. And when we did find game trails, it was amazing because even the smallest little fox trail was a saving grace to get to water or to at least find the way along the coast. So it really presented its own challenges, and challenges that we had anticipated, but then some that we hadn't, which included just finding our route if game trails weren't available. And the pack rafting was intense. We crossed The longest crossing I think we did in our pack rafts was Kajulik Bay, and that was about a six and a half hour pack raft, you know, the bay crossing there. We did face some sunshine in Hook Bay, which was where one of our team members got picked up from a small beaver. A friend of ours who lived in Chignik Lagoon organized a flight for him to get out because he had gotten hurt on the river. So there were, gosh, the stories go on and on. I mean, we have so many adventures out of there and so many things we learned from the trip that's what inspires me to do it again. Only two of us will be doing it again this summer.
Yeah, let me ask about that, because you might come out of a trip like this and say that was a once-in-a-lifetime incredible experience and I have enough stories to fill campfire banter for forever now. But you've decided to undertake what sounds like an even more intense or more involved trip. Describe this coming summer's endeavor.
So we'll do the Aniakchak portion of the trip again, where we get down into the caldera, although we're spending more time exploring the caldera this trip before we get on the Aniakchak River and out to the cabin. We'll skirt the coast and pack raft to Chignik Lagoon again, where we'll stop and replenish our supplies. And then from Chignik Lagoon, we'll try to take Metrophania as far as we can, Metrophania River as far as we can. We'll try to use our pack rafts and hike to Perryville. We've talked to some locals from Perryville and from Port Hyden to kind of map out the best route and to hit fishing holes and clam spots. So we'll get to Perryville, and then from Perryville, we will pick up our food supply and our fat tire bikes, and we'll fly to Port Moeller. And in Port Moeller, we'll start our journey back up the coast to Port Hyden via flat tire bike and our pack rafts.
That's just incredible. How do you think that's going to go?
Gosh, you know, I think that's the beauty in all of this, is that we can anticipate all we want, what's to come or what we'll face, but the adventure part of it is that we really have no idea. And I think the greater challenge than pack rafting will be to fat tire bike up the coast, because I'm not in shape to bike, I'll admit. I'd like to think that it'll just be a different type of challenge, I guess, than anything I've ever done, and I'm excited for that. But like any adventure, you take one day at a time and you troubleshoot one problem at a time, and it's all just a challenge. And I guess overcoming those challenges is what makes it exciting, and then what's inspired me to do it again, I guess, the Aniakchak portion at least, and then to extend the trip.
Well, Casey Luke, blazing new trails, and thanks for sharing about it. And we wish all of you a great adventure coming up this summer. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem, Dave. Thanks for getting in contact.
Well, if you have stories you'd like to share about your own adventures, reach out to me. We'd love to put them on this program. That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. You can find this and past episodes at our website, kdlg.org. We'll take feedback and ideas at news@kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. My thanks to Shaylin Cochran, Molly Dishner, and Hannah Colton. Hope to see many of you in Naknek tomorrow, and hope to see all of you back here next week.